and pigeons, birds that don't migrate. They found that only the robin's cryptochrome changed its behavior in the presence of a weak magnetic field. This feature could make the bird's field of view appear darker in the direction of a magnetic field line, letting them visualize which way is north. Pigeons do have a magnetic mineral called magnetite embedded in their beaks. So, even though they may not be able to see magnetic fields, they can detect them. This is what makes homing pigeons so good at finding their way back home. Birds on the move may use one or both ways of sensing magnetic fields. For Bird Note, I'm Mark.
I'm all in the ground, I'd root that mountain.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a five-star review.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
You're listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. This is live radio. Running on Air is a daily radio roundtable conversation with people running to represent Portland. In this episode, we're talking with candidates from District 4. We want you to join the conversation. You can call the air room with questions for candidates at 503-231-8187. You can message a question on the website, kboo.fm, and you can also email us your questions at runningonair@kboo.org. Let's meet our candidates for the day. Yay! Thanks for being here, you both. We are together with candidates Mitch Green and Ciata Thompson, running for Portland City Council District 4. Welcome.
Thank you.
Are you scared?
No, I'm excited.
Good. Good. Yeah, it's me, Lisa Loving. This is live radio. I haven't done something like this in so long. I'm just kind of excited and elevated by it. So, and yeah, I wanted to start with a lightning round and followed by a deep dive on the issues that we name in the lightning round. I have my little egg timer, my 2-minute hourglass, and I want to start with Ciata Thompson. Introduce yourself, but let us know what is the single most important issue that you think District 4 is facing. Go.
So I'm a working class candidate, and I currently work in the hospitality industry downtown. have now for the last handful of years. So I've been seeing the poor implementation of the last few years of policies, and dealing with crime, dealing with homelessness, dealing with drug addiction, a myriad of things, safety, overall with regards to my staff, my guests, and then obviously individuals that are coming into the hotels I work in crisis. Basically on our own without first responders, usually. So public safety for sure. That is universal across the board with every voter I talk to, with every individual. And tied to that, I would say affordability for sure, because a lot of individuals are getting pushed out of affordable housing and then ending up living on the street. So the cycle continues.
All right. Perfect. I'm pointing at my little green hourglass. You can't see it, I know, but it's very cool. Moving to Mitch Green, who are you and what's the most important thing that's impacting District 4?
Yeah, I'm Mitch Green. I'm running for Portland City Council in District 4. I have a PhD in economics. I'm an Army veteran. And I grew up in Portland. And I think for the folks who live in District 4, the most salient issue is visible poverty and homelessness, right? And that's the kind of thing that folks think about when they think about downtown, and frankly in many neighborhoods in District 4. And so I think it is pretty crucial that we act quickly to deal with the situation where folks don't have a place to sleep at night. Now, my view on that, though, is the most important issues depend upon which neighborhood that you're talking about in District 4. Like, for instance, if you live in Linton, the most important issue is the critical energy infrastructure hub and the fact that if there's an earthquake, you know, there's going to be a major ecological catastrophe there. If you live in Forest Park, the most important issue is perhaps the risk of wildfire. And if you live in Southwest Portland, you might be worried about your kids getting hit by a car. So I think it really does depend upon perspective, but they're all interconnected, and I think it's about addressing things at their root cause.
Can you both now help me define what is District 4? What are the boundaries? To me, when I looked at it, it's like it reaches across the Willamette. It includes neighborhoods that don't seem to have a lot to do with each other. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. What's your take on it?
I know the folks on the east side, Selwood, Reed, Eastmoreland, et cetera, are definitely concerned about feeling a part of the west side, particularly. I've heard that a lot. Even Southwest Portland, they are easily, concerned because it seems like the downtown and poverty sucks up a lot of air and a lot of the attention when it comes to that. I think the biggest thing that we get to do once we're on council is having three sets of eyes and ears will support in getting our folks' voices heard. And there'll be a lot more constituency work versus us trying to manage the bureau, run the office as well as legislate. So I think it will come together. It'll take some time, but I'm excited at the opportunity.
Mitch, what's your take on that, these new districts and how, District 4 stands out, I think it does, as being east side and west side, which is, it's mixing our metaphors for people who live here. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I really like the geography of District 4. It's a large district, but it also encapsulates many different aspects of the city. So you've got our urban forests in District 4. You've got...
it's wild, really.
Yeah, and you've got the sort of... Linton is kind of a... I keep going to Linton because it's such a magical little place and has so much opportunity there. But then you've also got, Selwood and Moreland and Reed, and those are... those are historically pretty progressive parts of Portland. And so there's this idea that the west side is just where all the rich people live, which is probably true. But it's also home. District 4 is home to some of the poorest people in our city. And so there's really a mix of perspectives and experiences for those people who live in District 4. I think that's pretty exciting.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Running on Air. It's KBOO Community Radio's election series, bringing panel discussions with candidates for Portland City Council. I'm Lisa Loving, and we are live in the studio with Mitch Green and Ciara Thompson, both candidates for Portland City Council District 4. Now I want to go back Ciata, because I had said, you know, I would love to talk with each of you about something that's important to you, like, you know, your own crucial issues. And you had basically, Ciata, as somebody who works in downtown Portland, who works in service industry, which is that the biggest industry?
Right now, yeah. Downtown restaurants, you know, clubs, bars, all of those things are the venues.
What fascinates me is that you're tying together the businesses plus the workers plus the people who live there. When I hear this conversation, I'm often only hearing from the business owners, mm-hmm. and we love you, small business owners. We do. Talk a little bit more about, if you were elected, what kind of policies would you be looking at putting in place to look at? I mean, I'm always going to say, to me, it sounds like real estate speculation is what brought a lot of the difficulty to Portland. And also, we've got a long history of homelessness here, a long, very, very long history. And that's a rabbit hole for me. So, Ciata, talk a little bit about what policies are on your platter for fixing or addressing some of those issues.
Sure. I would say within the first 100 days, one of the things I want to propose is a cut to small business taxes with 15 employees or less. They just did this year, Rubio and Wheeler proposed and pushed through, the city council voted for small businesses with 15 employees or more. But I think we really get to focus on those mom and pops that make up 94% of the businesses in Multnomah County that employ. We're talking the coffee shops, I mean, the pizza parlors, the sizzle pies, the places that everyone goes to on a daily basis, the laundromat, the bike repair shop. You might not go to your grocery store every single week, but you certainly go to the coffee shop or the bakery on a regular basis. So these folks are the ones that keep people employed. But if we're taxing them out of existence, it's going to be hard, particularly as we're seeing the worker strike on the East Coast and the Gulf. Prices are going to go up, things like that. We really have to do all that's possible to protect those businesses, because they're going to get hit hard. And if they start laying folks off, then we're going to just exasperate the affordability, and then we continue the cycle of poverty and homelessness. So we got to put some protections in place as much as we can without interfering with the free market. But we got to make sure that the regular folks can afford their lives.
That's Ciata Thompson. No, I have had enough coffee this morning. I just want to get everything exactly right. Turning to Mitch Green, getting it all right here. You had talked about the visible poverty and the homelessness in downtown that most affects you. What kind of this is a hot button issue. What would you do? What policies would you support in addressing that? And be careful, this is a hard one.
It is. But I came here for the hard questions. Now, I am firmly in the camp of the housing first approach to dealing with homelessness, addiction, mental health crisis. And I don't think there's any shortcuts to that. It's really expensive to deal with houselessness after it's happened. And so I strongly favor, putting in place policies that keep people from being homeless in the first place, right? Eviction and rental protections and stabilization measures. I also think that we can be really bold in the way that we address the use of the public purse and the scope of what the public sector does. And so if we want to house people, we should move quickly and take acquisitions from the standpoint of the city and say, we're going to build or acquire buildings that are vacant that can be used for housing first solutions. I don't think there's any way around it. And then longer term, I favor this idea called social housing, which is this idea that the public sector can and should develop its own portfolio of affordable housing that's truly affordable at all income levels. And so if you make $100,000 a year or you make $20,000 a year, you're still going to be 30% of your income. We already spent a lot on this stuff, so I think we should be more direct.
And I have to come back and say, you're listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm Lisa Loving, your host today. Running on Air is a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. In this episode, we're talking with candidates from District 4. We want you to join the conversation. Okay, are you listening right now? Phone lines are open. You can message a question on the website, kbu.fm. You can give us a call and talk to Althea at the board, 503-231-8187, or email us your questions, runningonair@kbu.org. Listen, y'all, now's the time. Phone lines are open. What do you want to ask these two candidates who are not the ones that I see every time I see a story about the elections? I'm going to put it like that. Again, 503-231-8187. Share your question with the engineer today, and we will put your question in front of these candidates. So I'm going to leap sideways briefly and say that climate change, right? Althea Billings, the KBU News Director, did a major survey of KBU listeners about what were the most important issues facing the city council, and climate change was the number one issue. So I want to, I'll switch it up a little bit and go to Mitch Green and say, climate change, what policies are you going to support against that?
Yeah, so I mentioned at the beginning that I do have a PhD in economics, and my specialty is in energy economics. I've, for the last decade, I've worked for the Bonneville Power Administration, and so I know a lot about what it takes to have a resilient energy system. And part of that experience is knowing that what's normal and what's not normal when it comes to extreme weather events. What we've been experiencing in Portland over the last few years is not normal. We're not supposed to have the deep cold freezes and the heat domes that we have had over the last few years, except for once in like maybe 100 years, but we're having those almost every year. So that tells me that we've got to make infrastructure investments to make our city more resilient. I got into the race because my neighbors lost power for a week, sometimes 2 weeks. And so I think that we can, use the Portland Clean Energy Fund, pair that with the Inflation Reduction Act credits that are on the table right now to make some resiliency investments in some of our communities so that way our most vulnerable aren't exposed, literally left out in the cold.
And that was Mitch Green. Going to bring this question to Ciotta Thompson. Issues of climate change and how they impact District 4. What are you going to do about it?
Well, I don't think we can have a real conversation about climate change without talking again about affordability. I would throw out that we should start looking at a public utility district. I know 20 years ago that was attempted. I think they may have tried to do too much in one measure, but now that we have the Portland Clean Energy Fund, we can pull the funding for a feasibility study from that. And we can just narrow down any future measures to simply yes or no and decide on, having the future city council decide on the board at some point. Anything that brings costs down. Right now, energy is just for the work. 45% increase in the last 5 years, hitting people's pockets as we see more and more. This is what's driving up the costs on a lot of items that we're buying at the grocery store, obviously at the gas station, all of the things. My main concern is, how are the working class and working poor going to be affected by any new proposal that we put forth? And then, of course, the CEI hub, that I don't typically hear a ton of conversation when it comes to that in the conversation of climate change, when it comes to the emissions that they spew literally every day.
Say that again. Which hub are you talking about?
The Central Energy Infrastructure Hub. Decentralized. So that is, we were just there at a Unshakable Forum on Sunday. They had several folks, well-intelligent folks who do this work, talking about the various concerns with the structure of the location and all of the dangers with how they would be able to, what happens if an earthquake happens.
I'm looking that up right now. I'm freaking that out. I never even heard of that. Love it. Keep going.
So basically, it's been there, 80 years nearly, and it's old. Mitch mentioned it multiple times. So with regards to the folks at Linton, great neighborhood of 300 folks, and they frequently get ignored. They're right across the bridge from St. John's, and the emissions are pumped out every day. And so you start to see folks having respiratory issues. Again, working class, working poor. If there were 300 millionaires living in Linton, I don't think we would be ignoring the issues. So that, again, coming back around to the real conversation that's affecting working class and working poor.
All right, a couple things. I'm going to back up a little bit there. I have to make a note. Corporate lobbying is my note. So the critical energy infrastructure hub, I'm just not familiar with that term. You're talking about the 6 mile area in northwest Portland along the Willamette River that has all those fuel tanks. Mm-hmm. When I first moved to Portland in 1987, I was hired by Ozperg to be the state publications director, and that little booger is what we were talking about. This was in 1987. Mm-hmm. So I have to, this is going to be a hard question. I'm just going to stick it to you guys. So much of the stuff that happens in Oregon actually happens at the state level with lobbyists, and then it gets handed down to the city. And I think that the energy policies are one of those things, the Zenith Oil Hub and stuff like that. But Ciotta Thompson, you had also mentioned the Public Utility District, right? And I'm old. I was here. I probably had your auntie in this room debating it, you know, 20 years ago. And the fact is that was killed by lobbying, straight up. I don't know who thought they were going to do something, but lobbying, corporate lobbying, hits the city of Portland like a sledgehammer. And the same thing happened with the Zenith Terminal, where the Zenith, the city of Portland, the city council created this policy that they were going to not have any further fuel hubs, fossil fuel infrastructure, that was the phrase. And then two members of the city council met behind closed doors. I mean, it's not, it's an open secret. They met behind closed doors with Zenith and basically signed an agreement, which still shocks me to the skies that someone would do that. And I gather that the excuse for that is, well, Zenith said they're going to do renewables now. But I have to put this to you. The history in the city of Portland from corrupt corporate entities is visible from space. There was a company called Enron. You may have heard of it. It was actually based here, and look it up, y'all. Enron. Zenith, again, it's this lobbying. I want to hear from each of you. What will you do in the face of really heavy corporate lobbying at the city level? Zenith was even popped because they weren't even registered as a lobbyist. And what, did they have to pay $5,000 in the face of billions in profit? I mean, it's the cost of doing business. So this is a hard question. What will you do in the face of this disproportional and really heavy corporate lobbying?
Well, yeah, it's a real thing that any elected official has to contend with. But my commitment is to the people that elect me to Portland City Council. At the end of the day, I answer to them. And I'm always going to consider the folks that are making and busting their hump and making their money hourly. You know, the fast buck, the quick buck comes and goes, but those who really last the longest, you know, maybe I'm being naive, just put the hard work in and stay committed to what they're up to. But it is a factor. I mean, there's a lot of voices pulling in a lot of directions for budgetary, you know, needs. But first things first for me is the working class, working poor, and then public safety. That's what all I'm about.
Mitch, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that lobbying is endemic to Portland. It's actually woven into the history of our city, and it's part of the reason why, I would say it's the reason why we lack the resiliency and the resources to make everyone whole and everyone safe and housed. So I'll tell you a little bit about my approach to politics here. I did not pursue, and I ignored invitations to participate in the United for Portland endorsement process, which is the business lobby. It's the big one. And the reason why I did it is because that's not who I aim to represent. The people that have endorsed me and the people who are supporting my campaign are students, climate leaders, socialists out knocking doors at the DSA, and labor unions. And so, you know, if I get elected, I know which way my bread is buttered. I've chosen a side here. And I think it's very difficult to hold the line for the public if you get brought into behind closed doors even before you're elected. I think the Zenith example is really instructive, where folks feel betrayed, particularly in the climate movement. And so my promise, I guess, is to say that, you know, I won't do that. And I think that the folks who got me elected will know how to call me in and hold me to account.
Okay, now here's one last question. This is harsh. This is harsh. I live for a few years in Cully, and now I live in this little slice of cheese neighborhood next to Cully called Sumner. And one thing that we've had to deal with repeatedly is what I describe as urban wildfires, okay? Mm-hmm. About 5 years ago, it may have been 6 years ago, a tire recycling company caught fire and burned for hours. And what is it, 21 cats killed. I know that a lot of people don't care about the cats, but it created a toxic cloud that went over Cully. I read too many newspapers, and I think about the wildfires in Southern California where people have, I'm going to say they've gentrified the forest. People insist on living in forested areas, and who doesn't want to live there because it's beautiful? But when the fires start happening, then you have the housing, the affordability, and the air quality and the danger, all of it happening at the same time. And so now I'm going to say this to you. What will you do if Forest Park catches on fire?
Yeah, some of the biggest concerns I got from this unshakable event on Sunday in Linton was, what is the county and city emergency management response? And to speak to Mitch's point, in this particular case, the conversation was around the CEI hub, but the thought just expanded to like, what emergency, like how do we handle emergencies, period, across the board? Like we just saw, on the East Coast, a devastating earthquake just come through. I'm a longtime resident of Florida. I will say they've got their things about Florida being Florida, but they know how to handle emergencies. They are well equipped to advise their residents what to do, where to go, days in advance. Now, I don't really see the same thing here. I don't see this ongoing education when it comes to like, here's where to go. Here's your resources. This is the action steps you need to take. So that, for me, would be top of mind. Again, something that I'd be working on the first 100 days, sitting down with city emergency planners and county emergency planners to see exactly, like, what is the plan? How do we educate the public on whether it's the CEI hub, whether it's a forest fire, whether it's what have you, protests, all the things that, how do we tell folks so that, again, folks feel safe, they feel informed, and they can move and conduct their lives and, free of concern, knowing that someone is paying attention and keeping their eye on the ball. So I could, that for me is where I'd start.
It's a big pizza, isn't it? Like, we're having a seat on the city council. You guys have to deal with so many things that it blows my mind. Mitch, what's your take? What if Forest Park catches on fire?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Ciata that I think we do need to beef up our emergency management and response capability. But my take as an economist is to say I'd much rather prevent it. And I think that there are things that we can do to make the risk of a fire in Forest Park really minimal.
Like what?
Well, for instance, I think the greatest source of risk is unsanctioned camping and people burning, creating fires for fuel and heat and that sort of thing. And I think the way that you deal with that is you provide adequate housing for everyone, so they don't have to live in a park. The next thing you can do is, one thing that I would like to champion, this is probably not an immediate thing, but a kind of a longer haul thing, is to say, why don't we have a green climate corps, job corps in Portland? And so you can go out and do proactive ladder fuel. That's like, ivy that grows up trees and, kind of quick burning stuff. Like, let's trim that out. Let's do some proactive forest health maintenance in that area, that precious area of our city. So that way we can keep the risk low. Those are things that I care about. And, frankly, instead of joining the Army, I would have preferred to join something like the Green Climate Corps if that existed. To pay for college. So I think that there are things that we can do. We don't have to sort of accept this world in which we're going to have to react to disasters.
I want to apologize to both of you because I'm old. I've been a reporter in this town for about 200 100 years. And I'm old enough to know when people have thought that they were fixing all this stuff, right? And I bet millions of dollars over the past 20 years have been pumped into just the city of Portland to create a green job sector. Van Jones, right, who now you see him on, what is it, Fox? He used to be an environmentalist. He used to come over here and talk about it. And this is like 15 or 20 years ago. Politics is a great big memory hole in a lot of ways. And I wanted to also say that I went through the neighborhood emergency training. I spent almost 15 years working at what's called the Scanner newspaper, African-American family-owned newspaper in the city of Portland. And one of our biggest issues after Katrina is how the POEM, Portland Office of Emergency Management, doesn't really do anything to reach out to communities of color to bring them into what's called the NET program, Neighborhood Emergency Training Program. I went through the Neighborhood Emergency Training Program. I'm going to tell you right now, I think everybody should go through that. I learned how to put out a fire. I learned how to set a broken bone. What? I learned how to get a building off of somebody. They don't teach that in school. But the biggest thing that I learned was the whole thing was run by firefighters. And the biggest thing I learned is that all the firefighters don't live in the city of Portland. They all live in the suburbs. When the earthquake happens, the bridges are going to fall and you're going to be on your own. That fascinated me. But I think that I haven't heard any kind of update about what the city or the county Office of Emergency Management, what they've done to actually bring racial equity. And as you're talking about, like working class, you know, bringing everybody into this program so that everybody's got a piece of their neighborhood. During World War II, people did that. I know that's maybe not a great thing to reference now, but people actually created teams in their neighborhoods so that they could make sure everybody was fed, make sure everybody had clothes. But yeah, that one fascinates me. And you should take that. People should consider taking that NET training. I don't think it's free, actually, but it is really a big deal. I have a few things to say in addition to that now. You're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're speaking with candidates from District 4, Mitch Green and Ciata Thompson. We're waiting for you to join the conversation by calling in with your questions to the air room, 503-231-8187. I could make some suggestions to you guys about what you could be asking about, but I'm not. I'm letting you call us, and then we're going to ask the questions. I also have to say, support for Running on Air comes from KBOO members and the League of Women Voters. More information about the candidates on your ballot can be found on the League of Women Voters of Portland's website, lwvpdx.org. The League has videos of candidate interviews and forums, as well as links to candidates' written answers to questions and explanations of ballot measures. That's lwvpdx.org. And we are back with my two cool new friends, Mitch Green and Ciata Thompson. Okay, now I've got a really weird question. This is weird. Nobody's going to ask you this. Okay. Traditionally, I've lived in Portland for like, I don't know, 35 years. I know I'm a newcomer. I know, I've been told. But traditionally, there were people who ran for office in the city, not the county, but the city, especially city council and mayor, to learn about the city. Like, it was a thing. Like, people would do it. I'm not going to say for fun, because how much fun is in it? I'm not asking you that question. But people did it as an adventure. In fact, I knew this guy. I think his wife was a juggler, and he and his best friend decided they were going to run for office and see who they could meet, see what it meant, right? One was the mayor candidate. The other was his chief of staff. And, they met everybody. They met the other candidates. They met the people who were elected mayor. They met everyone who ran the media outlets. It was the coolest thing ever, honestly. You know, and I can also remember a time, maybe it was more like more than 20 years ago, maybe more like at the millennium, where a group of goths, seriously, people in their 20s who were goths created a slate, because it only costs like $150 to get your notice in the voter guide, you know, for those who remember to do that. But I mean, and you would be looking at that, and they had black lipstick, and they were really weird, and you'd be looking them up. I mean, it was a thing. One of the main reasons why people did this was a sense of adventure, but also to find out what they didn't really know about the city. My question to you both, What are you learning in this process about the office you want to hold that you didn't know before you started running? And I'm going to ask you first, Mitch, what do we who are voters don't even know about this town that you've been learning because you've been walking through this pathway?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a really interesting question. For me, what I have learned is just how deeply embedded our past decisions at the budget level, at the programmatic level, are in terms of creating the kind of like boundaries today. And so, you know, when we think about all the policies we want to pass and how to pay for it and what are the trade-offs, you really get a close-up look to the consequences of a previous generation's choices. And that's why it's extremely critical, I think, to have wide participation in this process and to kind of really open up and democratize the knowledge and the accessibility there, because I think that we've maybe made some poor choices. And you know.
What are people asking you about? When people are really angry and they're showing up at your stuff and we can't curse, what are they asking you about?
They say it's different variations on this theme, which is like, I pay a lot of taxes. I have voted for these taxes. Why do we still see the problems? Why is this pothole not filled? Why do I see tents on the street? And there's a lot of different ways candidates can answer that. And I've got my approaches, of course, but
I already said earlier, I read too many newspapers, and I've read the Los Angeles Times. I, you know, of course, I've got a subscription to the Los Angeles Times. I live in Portland, Oregon, but really, as falls Los Angeles, so falls Portland. And the Karen Bass, their mayor that was elected last year, one of the things that she said really caught my eye, because I think that traditionally LA is considered to be the place with the most unhoused people living in the street, maybe in the United States. There might be more unhoused people in New York City, but they passed a law a generation ago that made it illegal for the city not to provide housing for people that needed it. So they have a completely different system. I'm not saying it's perfect. But one of the things that Karen Bass said was, the most important thing is not to solve the problem of unhoused people. The most important thing is to hide it and get rid of the tents, which fascinated me. And I want to bring this question, though, over to Ciara Thompson. What have you learned from just this process of running for office that you didn't know before, or that maybe we don't know?
Well, again, one of the scariest things for me that I've learned was the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub. It was like, holy cow, this is a thing that exists and no one talks about it. Literally no one talks about it. That I encountered on a regular basis. I'm a 5-minute drive from there. So it really was like, I'm literally right
there. And it's right by Forest Park. I'm sorry, we're going to snack them up. Go ahead.
Thinking of forest fires, like just all the things. So for sure that was it. And then the walkability and bikeability issues for Southwest Portland, that was eye-opening. And you know, for the folks, I mean, those highways are 100 years old, and the fact that literally no one thought to build a sidewalk is interesting at any point in the 100 years. But to speak to what Mitch brought up, it's like the diversity of, you know, the diversity matters, not just checking the box of we have a girl or we have a boy and we have a, you know, everything in between, and there's a black person and there's a, you know, that is, we need to really think of and diversity of thought, diversity of background, economic diversity as well. Like, not if everyone owns a house and drives a car, of course they didn't think about building sidewalks. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things come into play when you're looking at the city as a whole. If you have always worked for non-for-profit, then you don't know what it's like for a small business owner to scratch out a living, like the challenges of that. You know, if you had a silver spoon in your mouth, you don't know what it's like to have to work overtime to make ends meet, or all of these things. So, you know, I'm excited with the opportunity to have, you know, now that the city council will be expanded to 12 instead of the 4 that it is now. But yeah, I mean, it's just, we need more diversity, especially as we're coming into the next stage of evolution as a city, breaking out of the small small town mindset. I love the small town values, but that also has had us, that Mitch touched on, that that stays stuck, where it's like that not in my backyard, why we couldn't have height, why we couldn't have density. You know, we're encountering an aging population. How do we attract younger, more diverse folks to Portland? All of those things are questions that have become front of mind for me as I've been running my race.
You're fascinating me here, because I think about this all the time. I've lived here too long. I've gone to other places and thought, no, I love Portland. I'm going to go back there. I love KBOO. How can I live without it? That's my family, right? If you're listening, yeah, I just said you're my family. And you better be nice at the holidays and when it's my birthday. But it always strikes me, the old, that old quote from Tom McCall, welcome to Oregon, now go home, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know if other regions in the United States have that same ethos. I'm guessing other places must. But when you look at the it's a conflict, sort of a conflict between the haves and the have-nots in Oregon, and it shakes down differently. And then it finally hits Portland, the biggest urban area, which does take a majority of the resources that the state has, and for reasons, I suppose. This is what I want to ask you both. I think that issue of the conflict of resources, it's just more evident than it's ever been, right? What, 10 years from now, what do you think is going to be the most important issue that we didn't deal with that's going to blow up in our faces 10 years from now? Could be something already on your list, but that's what I want to ask you. I'm asking you to dust off your crystal ball. Tell me about the future.
Well, like I just said, I think we're aging population, lower tax revenues. If things don't turn things around, that'll be something that China is struggling with, like the lack of growth in population. That's a real thing, because we need humans to operate and run a city. You know, taxpayers fund the city. So these are similar things that Detroit was struggling with not too long ago when they hit bankruptcy. People were fleeing from the city, so they put in different measures and were able to get themselves. Now they're on a resurgence, so it's possible. But one of the biggest things that for me is the aging population, and how do we bring in youth, young, professional, diverse demographic to keep the city going and growing. So that's where I'm coming from.
That surprises me. That's not what I expected, and I'm going to be obsessing over that for the near future. Okay, Mitch, what's your take? 10 years from now, what is the biggest issue that we're not really tracking now that's just going to blow up?
I think we are tracking this, what I'm about to say, but I don't know if folks recognize the urgency, and it's a two-sided coin here. It's the lack of abundance of housing, and also our transportation priorities. If 10 years from now, if we don't change a course and do a dramatic increase in the scale of housing production and you know, frankly, maybe look at some rent control, and take another stab at that, then we are going to have a situation where people who do move here, who are in earlier parts of their career, cannot afford to stay in the county and raise a family. And so you're going to have this big suburban commuting issue. Traffic is going to be so much worse than it is today. If you think it's already as bad as it can get, I got to tell you, it can get so much worse. And so we've really got to make some pretty aggressive investments in dense, walkable neighborhoods and really straighten out our transit system. And we've got to do it fast.
And you know, when you say that, I go back to the why don't I have a sidewalk in front of my house issue. And over at the Willamette Week, the guy who's their question and answer guy, he did a column on this earlier this summer where somebody said, I mean, why the hell can we just have a street that isn't filled with potholes? And that guy went and he lifted up his phone, he talked to a few people, and the answer was, the biggest answer was that Mayor Vera Katz back in the day deprioritized streets. Mm-hmm. You know, she has not been the mayor in 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it was a decision made years ago that is absolutely having, I mean, that's one of the biggest issues that people don't talk about enough, because we give up, right? Mm-hmm. And I've read it in Bike Portland, so I guess that makes it anecdotal, but fewer people are riding their bikes. And I have to tell you right now, the streets are not really safe to ride a bike in. And even with all the additional bike, traffic furniture and all the beautiful, I love that shade of green that they paint the roads and stuff like that, but it doesn't make the streets safer. And we're breathing, and we're going to come back and say, you're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. KBOO Community Radio rocks, by the way, and you should volunteer here, but I'm getting off topic. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Today, we're speaking with candidates from District 4, Mitch Green and Ciotta Thompson. You can join the conversation. What are you doing right now, and why are you not joining the conversation? We're actually waiting for you, right, to give us a call at 503-231-8187. Ask a question. What are you doing right now? Ask a question. You'll talk to a nice person, and that person's going to write it down. Just putting that out. All right, we can talk, and we will. But this really is also about you, the listener, because we here at KBOO are bringing candidates into a space where you can ask questions, and you don't even have to put on clothes. I mean, I said that. Anyway, 503-231-8187 is the number. Give us a message through the website, kboo.fm, and we're going to go back. We have about, another 15 minutes left, and I have a couple questions that I wanted to ask, but I'm going to come back down to the one that freaks me out. All right. What kind of law enforcement or emergency services structure do you support? And I'm asking that. I'm not just going to ask you, what kind of law enforcement and emergency service structure do you support, right? Because we have that conversation where my mom lives in California, and her friend, her best friend, the Trump supporter, he's still convinced that the entire city of Portland burned down because we drove all the police out, okay? And that's not what happened. But this is what I want to ask you. When a significant natural or social disaster hits within the city of Portland that brings significant infrastructure to a halt, which first responders do you expect to be there doing what? And what will local resident volunteers be expected to do? This is a trick question. I want to go with Mitch.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, if we've got a natural disaster.
Or social disaster.
Or social disaster. I would prefer to see non-armed public safety officials show up first, whether that's Portland Street Response, whether that's the firefighters or, public safety specialists, EMTs and those sorts of people trained in de-escalation, but people who have a basket of skills that's not just shooting at something. To me, that is how you get people to calm down. I have worked, I was a soldier, and I have some experience in conflict zones, and I know that to develop order and safety, it takes rapport building and a light touch. And I think if we're going to have a social disaster, I think that sort of alludes to riots. It alludes to sort of that sort of thing. I think policing your way through that is not the approach.
Yeah, because even as you're listing those out, I didn't even ask you about Portland versus Multnomah County. That is its own can of worms. We could talk about that for an hour. I'm not saying that's not a worthwhile thing to ask, and I might come back to that at the end. But from the county to the city, almost every first responder is in disarray now, right? The emergency medical technicians, the ambulance drivers. Years and years ago, 15 years ago, I was covering the Multnomah County union negotiations with the EMT companies, and it was dank, and nobody ever fixed the problems then, right? That's the part that gets me. None of these are new, really, and they could have been fixed a long time ago. But we are back to what emergency responders, law enforcement, or emergency services structure do you support, and when a significant natural or social disaster hits within the city of Portland that brings significant infrastructure to a halt, which first responders do you expect to be there doing what?
It goes back to what I mentioned previously, like having a comprehensive, a cohesive emergency management plan is necessary so that all bodies and that are involved need to know where to go and what to do, particularly our first responders. And when it comes to, you know, social unrest, those are things we can't have what happened in 2020 happen again. Unfortunately, that scared a lot of businesses away. That's why Portland downtown is the husk that it is. You know, it doesn't, having folks just riot and destroy things is not conducive to building a healthy and healthy society and city, thriving city. So that's where I start. I think obviously we need to have our EMTs, we need to have Portland Street Response, Fire Bureau, all of those pieces in place. Police, they get to keep the peace. I mean, that needs to be in place. I know that the perception of police has been dragged through the mud in the last handful of years. I personally think that they have an important role in the community, particularly when it comes to social unrest, those type of concerns that it doesn't have to be combative, but they can certainly keep the order. When it comes to some sort of natural disaster of some sort, they will can at least keep the boundaries so that if electrical wire is down the street, if the road is like burst open, we need to have these individuals in place to ensure public safety. So I'm 100% behind all of our first responders, and I want them to be able to do their jobs at every level.
All right, and we have about 10 minutes left. We have a question or two from listeners. Ross, I bet it's Ross Danielson, wants to know, what do you see as the future of neighborhood associations in Portland?
I think, I mean, they still have a crucial role. I know that, again, a lot of what we talked about is decisions made in the last 20, 30, 40 years are still, we're paying the prices now. Let's be frank, you know, as far as inclusion, diversity, all of those things, that hasn't been a strong suit when it comes to these neighborhood organizations. I think that if we can invite the neighborhoods and put the word out using social media, all of the things that don't have to cost a ton of money, inviting folks, maybe moving meetings from a Tuesday night at 6 to a Saturday afternoon at 2, that will invite more folks from who have to work their two jobs and have to take care of their three kids, and offer more opportunity for folks that may not have all the time in the world that in doing a typical work week to come and be involved in their neighborhood. So I think there's a wide opportunity for them, but there's still more growth, and you know, we're all learning.
All right, and Mitch, I'm putting my foot on the gas here. So Mitch, what do you think?
Yeah, just real briefly, I think neighborhood associations will continue to be an important way that people engage in civics. You know, it's usually how people get their first touch on politics in a city. I do think that they tend to overrepresent homeowners at the expense of renters. So I think that it's incumbent on leadership. So those of us who get elected should do our best to try to steer those associations so that they're a little bit more accessible, represent a broader set of views.
Okay, here's another question from Doug. What do you think about police having to walk a beat in the neighborhood they're from?
100%. Like, that's how I've seen policing done in the cities that I've grown up in, that they knew Mr. and Mr. Smith, the shop owner, that they'd go have lunch at the neighborhood food truck. I would see them just hanging out and, you know, walking by as kids. Hi, officer so-and-so. Hey, how you doing? And there was an actual relationship. So we knew them as people. They knew us as people. And at least we're friendly. You may not have been best friends, but, you know, they knew your parents, and they were deeply involved in the community. They went to the businesses that they were serving and protecting. And I think that's vital. It just makes sense. We need to stay and get back to that.
Awesome. Mitch?
Well, most police don't live in the city of Portland. But, you know, to do justice to the question, I'm not opposed to walking a beat. I mean, I think that's better than sitting in a car and playing Candy Crush.
There was something that I wanted to say about, oh, I know what it was. Remember I told you how old I am? I'm like 150 years old. When I first moved to Portland, the Portland police and also the Portland public schools each had programs so that for teachers and police, and I probably also non-sworn officers, could apply and get help to buy a home in the city. And it was 1987. That's when they started getting rid of those, because we talk about having the police live in the, hang out in the neighborhood that they live in. But it's the same with teachers, actually. So moving really quick along, and this is a hard question. This might even be our last question. Elliot in Northwest Portland says he was on the non-emergency phone line with police on hold for 2 hours about a garage break-in, and no one got back to him. Is addressing that response time important to you?
Yes, absolutely. I know the feeling, Elliot. I've certainly, just in recent memory, I've had to call the 911 a few weekends ago in regards to a houseless individual who said he was feeling suicidal. And 3 hours went by and no one came. So, and I have been on that phone call, that non-emergency line, and waiting and waiting and waiting, and if a guest car gets broken into, what have you. So, yeah, it's deeply frustrating. A thriving city needs to be able to action the emergencies when people are reaching out for help from their first responders in a timely manner. That's like no-brainer, yes.
Awesome. Mitch?
That's a huge priority for me. It's pretty intolerable. You should be able to call a number, get someone to answer very quickly. A non-armed officer, public safety specialist, should be able to show up, take your police report so you can fill out your insurance claim. It should be painless.
Okay, last quick question. Do you support expanding Portland Street Response or not?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, last 5 minutes. We're going to call it the last 4.5 minutes. I'm going to give the microphone to Ciara and say, what's the most important thing in 2 minutes or less that voters should know about what you're going to do if you get your hands on the wheel?
You vote for me. You can find my platform at ciaraforportland.com. And again, coming from a working class background, that's top of mind when it comes to public transit expansion, when it comes to any type of fiscal policy. It's going to always be, whether it's green economy and all the way down, up and down, it's going to be how does it affect the working class and working poor, because those are the individuals that are being hurt right now. And I'm talking folks even six figures who I'm seeing and talking to more and more who are working two jobs. You know, the median income for this district is $94,000. That used to be good. And now you're seeing more and more people struggling, just who are making $125,000, just because all the costs have gone up. That's, for me, is what's most important to me. And that's the people that I'm going to be representing.
It's almost like a climate change of our lives. Mitch?
Yeah, Mitch Green, Mitch4Portland.com. Please check it out. I think what you should know about me, the single takeaway, is that because I am an economist, if I'm on city council, I'm going to be able to call BS on any claims that we cannot afford to invest in our communities. And I'm also going to be able to sort of champion different ways to approach our budgeting process, so that way it is not so expensive to live here. And we can make this a city that can weather the storm and be resilient and build sidewalks, right? So I hope you vote for me.
All right, that is it for our show. Mitch Green and Ciara Thompson, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. You can find all the episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Episodes are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer and engineer is Althea Billings, and our editor is Eric Leuschner. Tune into the next episode of Running on Air tomorrow. At 7 p.m., we're going to be joined by City Commissioner Carmen Rubio, who's running for mayor. I've been your host, Lisa Loving. Thanks for listening. And hey, you should be a KBOO volunteer. You should be emailing volunteer@kboo.org. And did I just say that or did I think it? Thanks for tuning in and stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts OB Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO FM.
Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Hi, it's Al Franken telling you to listen to KBOO, KBOO, community radio, 90.7 here in Portland.